import tariffs and retaliatory measures. Back then, Trump accused China of unfair trade practices and intellectual property theft. Beijing responded with rising tariffs on U.S. goods. The tit-for-tat move escalated following Trump's second-term inauguration, with the U.S. imposing additional tariffs on Chinese goods just days into his new term. China retaliated with levies on a number of U.S. products, including coal and agricultural ones. By March, the conflict intensified further, targeting a broader range of imports. Beyond tariffs, the U.S. has ramped up its pressure campaign to contain China's power rise through sanctions. In the latest attempt, Washington blacklisted dozens of Chinese entities, including technology firms, aiming to restrict Beijing's development of high-performance computing capabilities. The U.S. government justified the move by citing national security and foreign policy concerns. China, however, accused Washington of weaponizing trade and technology in a typical act of hegemonism.
We urge the U.S. to stop generalizing the concept of national security and stop abusing all kinds of sanction lists to unreasonably suppress Chinese enterprises.
Tensions, however, have been extending far beyond trade. A recent U.S. intelligence report has identified China as, quote, the most comprehensive and robust military and cyber threat to American national security. The report, which compiles assessments from U.S. intelligence agencies, warns of Beijing's ability to hit the U.S. with conventional weapons, compromise U.S. infrastructure through cyber attacks, target assets in space, and challenge America's dominance in artificial intelligence. Beijing has reacted to the report, calling it biased, and accused Washington of exaggerating the China threat.
We advise the U.S. not to use its own hegemonic logic to mirror China, not to view China-U.S. relations with outdated Cold War thinking, not to contain and suppress China in the name of strategic competition, and not to exaggerate the China threat.
Beijing has also urged Washington to scale back its military presence in the South China Sea and halt its support for Taiwan, which China considers part of its sovereign territory. The report also shows that Washington has grown increasingly uneasy about China's deepening ties with its allies, including key U.S. adversaries such as Russia and Iran. As the two powers maneuver for influence across the globe, the tension between them is no longer a bilateral affair. It has become a global chess match with implications for every corner of the world. How will these tensions shape the future of international relations? Only time will tell.
Welcome back. Allow me to introduce my guests. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, joining us from Bradenton, U.S. And Daniel Patrick Wells, geopolitical analyst and political commentator, joining us from Boston, also from the U.S. Gentlemen, very good to have you on the program. I'm going to start my very first question with you, Larry. How does China's growing military and economic power challenge the United States' global power?
Well, it's a threat that the United States has created. Look, if I walk up to you and I start poking you in the chest, and then I put hands on your wife, and you punch me back, and then the person punched says, I've been attacked unjustly. Well, that's not true. And that's exactly what's been going on here. You know, we can write, I was going to propose writing the book, Chinese Overseas Military Adventures. The problem was it'd only be about a chapter long, because the only time that China has actually done any kind of military activity outside of its territorial boundaries was back in 1979 when it fought Vietnam on behalf of, because of Vietnam's war with Cambodia. So the fact of the matter is, it's not China that's been the military expansionist. It's not China that has 700 plus military bases around the world. It's not China that basically started a war with Libya and then invaded Iraq and invaded Afghanistan and started a war with Syria. That's not China, that's the United States. So what we're engaged here with is the United States is doing a form of what the psychologists call projection. They're assigning to China the blame for what we're doing. And China's listened. You know, there was just about a year ago that a U.S. admiral, the deputy commander, I believe, in Indo-PACOM, segment of the U.S. military responsible for the Asia-Pacific region. It was said openly that, hey, we're going to be at war with China by the end of 2025. Well, if you're Chinese leaders, particularly intelligence officials and military leaders, you have to take that as a serious threat and prepare accordingly. And so when China prepares in response to the bellicose rhetoric of the United States, China is then blamed, oh, China is trying to take over the world. It's just a lie.
Right. I'm going to ask the same question to Daniel. Daniel, how do you think this, you know, the Chinese, if I can call it hegemony, or if the Chinese influence over the world, how is it going to affect the American power and influence? How can they not work together for a shared objective, for example?
Well, I love what Larry said. I can't really add to it too much. But it is important to look at what the U.S. has done in that the psychological example that he uses, that they're accusing, like every sociopath, accusing its greatest victim of its own crimes. And to say, I think what you asked was, don't these work together, right? First of all, to bring economies up, to bring people up, to focus on development, yes, that is a universal objective that you can say is a common purpose of all nations, corporations, human beings on Earth. But if your point is to be at the top of the pile, that's like if your only objective is playing king of the hill, then you're only looking at who to kick down, who's climbing up too fast. So what China is doing wrong is actually playing at the same game, which is not to take over, but to develop. And this is a thing that China has set, you know, one of the interesting things, you're dealing with the Trump administration, which is a flash in the pan, really, except for its embrace of long-term strategy of keeping the U.S. in the driver's seat and in the position of control over all the other countries in the world. But this thing of being, you know, say, long-term planning, right? This is since the Sino-Soviet split. This is Nixon and the reestablishment of relations with the West is a blink of an eye ago for China. I wish the U.S. could think in the same way. That's what they're saying. Don't think in these these Cold War hegemonic logic, but think in longer terms. This is how the world works, and we are doing something that they pledged to do 50, 70 years ago, is to beat them at their own game, not because they want to win the game, but because if you stay out of foreign affairs, like they have remarkably done, compared to the Soviet Union, and obviously specifically compared to the U.S., and used every other variable to climb up and take over the position, say in AI and chip development, and even in military development, then you really are a threat. If you change the rhetoric a little bit, you really are a threat because you're doing it right. And this is, of course, whether they say it or not, this is the problem. The problem with China is it's too good. You can't say that because you sound like a toddler or something. But that is why. That is what Ukraine is about. That is what Libya is about. That is what putting typhoons in Philippines is about, trying to muscle in on AUKUS or the Strait of Taiwan. All of that is to counter a real competitor, and to do it unfairly and to cheat at it if you can, because that's how you've got where you are if you're the U.S. and it works. And if you can cheat them and beat them, then that's a good strategy.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, I'm going to get back to the technological side that you just mentioned and also the issue of Taiwan. But I'm going to talk to Larry right now. You are a former CIA analyst. Tell me, what are the implications of China's alignment with the likes of Russia, Iran, and North Korea for the model of international stability that is proposed by the U.S., the American model?
Well, it depends on which assumptions you make and where you sit. The United States, well, the Trump administration right now, at the senior levels, as well as, you know, most pundits that deal with Asia, as well as the think tanks that populate the United States, all believe that there's no way that Russia and China can have any kind of real, lasting, long-term relationship. I mean, good God, they're those stinky Chinese. They're, you know, ugh, yellow and ugh. Because the Russians are like us, racially pure. I mean, that's the subterfuge to this. And they really believe that they can split Russia off China. And it's so cynical, because this is like we're telling them to break up with their partner so that we can rape them. You know, we're going to rape Russia first, and then we'll deal with China. I had a chance to interview Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, just myself and two other individuals. And I specifically asked him about this. And he answered in a way that Daniel will appreciate, because he repeated the point that Daniel was making. He goes, you know, we've got a history with China, and it hasn't always necessarily been good, but we have a relationship now that's founded on mutual respect. It's economic, it's political, it's military. But he says the Chinese have a much longer time horizon. And he put his hand up like this. They've got a much longer view of things than we do. But he says this is a genuine relationship, and we recognize that we cannot put ourselves in a position where we're going to be beholden or vulnerable to Western economic control. So very clear on that point, that Russia and China have entered into a relationship. And this isn't recent, because notice that starting in 2019, Russia and China began conducting annual joint naval military exercises with Iran. And those exercises started in 2019. And the fact that that was when it was first executed, in March of 2019, that means the planning for it started no later than 2018 and most likely started in 2017. So basically, we're saying for the last 8 years, Russia, China, and Iran have been talking about the need for an economic realignment that also entails military support. And one of the reasons for that is what Russia's proposing is a north-south highway or railway that's going to extend from the port cities in southern Iran and will run up through Azerbaijan into Russia. This way, they circumvent all the madness in the Red Sea and the Suez Canal, and Russia is no longer dependent upon the kind of influence that the West exercises there. So that's one of the big things that's at play here.
Right, thank you, Larry. I'm going to ask Daniel about the Taiwan issue between the two countries. Well, the U.S. presidents, the U.S. governments tend to always complain about China's coercive pressure on Taiwan. But at the same time, the Chinese government always says that this is intervention in our internal affairs. So how is this issue going to overshadow the future of the relations between the two countries?
Well, I mean, overshadowing is I, with all due respect, I think is the wrong word to use, because it's essential. That's the only actual defense mechanism. Remember my thing about the toddlers, right? If that's the only argument you have, you start with it. It's like saying the Republic of Texas, you know, is being bullied by the U.S. Or, I mean, you can't even make up an anecdote as ridiculous as this. You see slippage in the commitment to the One China policy that helped bring China into the UN, into the global atmosphere in general. And there's some language changes on the website. I didn't pay attention to the actual details, but something is slipping in terms of towing the line that they've always said since then, which is that there is one China, and Taiwan is part of China. Now, if you try to interject as using that to split China, then you obviously have given up on the overall idea, which makes your position completely untenable. You cannot have a relationship with China in the current meaning, the last 70 years, without accepting that as the premise. And once you poke under that skin, it is completely, it's like in a personal relationship, it's completely obnoxious. We're not talking about that. Hey, stop that. I told you, that's off the table. That's always been off the table. Don't keep telling us that. And what, again, as Larry pointed out well, too, is that the arguments coming against it are actually the arguments that you would put for it. They say China is making Taiwan an issue or a problem. They're being coercive. They're being subversive. I love when they use that language. Like nothing could fit the U.S. perspective better than that, but it's always the other person who's being coercive and subversive. And they're trying to use Taiwan when all they're doing is exactly what they said from the beginning. Taiwan is China, and you cannot fund the opposition. Some have small group military joint exercises that are, you know, only inches from mainland China. You know, I mean, it's insane that the U.S. tries to flip it like that. But they are going to continue to use Taiwan, and they will fail because they are failing in the general sense, like we have been covering so far. They're losing the big game, and these are tiny pieces on the chessboard, and they're going to lose those too.
Right, Larry, America, on the other hand, is reinforcing its presence in the South China Sea area. What justifies that?
The American dynasties are losing their shirt in Ukraine. You know, we just had a press report here in the last 4 hours out of the New York Post about four American soldiers that died in Lithuania or Latvia, supposedly. I guarantee they were killed in Ukraine. And they're using the cover to Latvia or Lithuania to cover that. So the overall sentiment is, you know, we can't defeat Russia, so therefore we better move on to get prepared to defeat China, which is it's insane. It's a crazy position, but I guess it's perceived that has the best, let's call it, economic prospects for the military-industrial complex, which has been profiting from the war in Ukraine. And now is looking to profit from a buildup to a non-existent, I'll call it a non-existent military threat from China, because China is not planning to attack anybody. China is taking defensive measures that are provoked by us. And in return, we get to pretend that they're going to attack us, which then allows us to say, hey, man, that defense budget, $1 trillion is not enough. Let's kick it up to $1.2 trillion. We're gonna keep Western money overseas and impoverishing the American people.
Right. Daniel, China always claims right now that the U.S. is weaponizing trade and financial affairs to inflict hits on this country, and they're just reacting to what they are seeing from the American side. Your take on that?
I think that's exactly right. You know, that is, I love listening to the, you know, both the Chinese and the Russian perspectives, because it's a breath of fresh air in some sense. Not that I have to agree with it, but it is just the bare bones truth. All they're doing is doing what they're doing. And the Americans are then using it, weaponizing it, exactly as they said. And Guo Jiakun, the spokesperson for the foreign ministry, who said that this is illegal. This is using, you can't use sanctions and our foreign policy as a means to justify what you're calling economic decisions, because they're not. And that is what the U.S. has used going back, at least to Kissinger. One of the things about realpolitik is that Kissinger was using both truth, and he wasn't dealing with a Bush league, no pun intended, of used car salesmen who knew how to make this deal by dealing with reality and not just browbeating people. You can't win the argument or the deal that way. It's not a used car. Shuttle diplomacy is not about selling real estate.
Right, gentlemen, thank you so much. I wanted this conversation to go on for an hour, but unfortunately, for the sake of time, we have to end this. Thank you so much for your presence once again. Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst, joining us from Bradenton, U.S., and Daniel Patrick Wells, geopolitical analyst and political commentator, joining us from Boston, also from the U.S. And thank you so much for staying with us on another Spotlight. We'll see you back tomorrow.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam treated all human beings to be equal in the matter of rights and responsibilities, and he did not fix any limit in this behalf of equality among all human beings. And if he did fix any such limits, it was fixed keeping in mind the interests of the public in general, the people. And when we study the character of Imam Ali, we clearly see that he did not violate this freedom, the freedom of the people, the freedom of the public, the freedom in any of his laws, orders, rules, or regulations, and he always kept the public welfare in his view, in all his actions. He dealt equal treatment to both his friends and his foes.
نور الرحمن فيك أنزل القرآن الله يا الله لا إله إلا
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we are speaking about the holy month of Ramadan, and we are speaking about His Eminence, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. What a beautiful month to be witnessing, and what a beautiful month to be speaking about His Eminence, the first divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam. And of course, what a beautiful month that unfortunately is coming down towards its end. Of course, in advance, we hope that the believers, wherever they are, have a safe and secure and faithful Eid day, the Eid celebration all across the world. You know, one of the things that we learn from His Eminence Imam Ali alayhi salam is, of course, two things that I want to, inshallah, speak about, if Allah permits. And, of course, this is something that, you know, even though it is the end of the holy month of Ramadan, or we're coming close to the end of the holy month of Ramadan, it is something that we need to really kind of, you know, keep in our minds, inshallah. And as we move forwards, you know, to continue these things that we have learned. And this is, of course, something that over multiple years we have very humbly put forth, is that those things that we learn in the holy month of Ramadan, that we should continue them throughout the rest of the year with Allah's permission and Allah's grace. So one thing is the protection and the help of the oppressed. The support of the oppressed is something that Imam Ali alayhi salam most definitely has shown throughout his life, whether it is physically defending the oppressed, whether it is ideologically helping the oppressed, because teaching a person knowledge is also freeing a human being from the shackles of oppression, evil and tyranny and Satan and the satanic forces. They oppress people physically, yes, but also ideologically and mentally and spiritually by misinformation, by lies, by propaganda, and by keeping them dumb and keeping them ignorant. And so, yes, providing knowledge to people out there, truth and justice, and providing them with the reality of the pure Muhammadan Islam is a form of helping the oppressed to get out of this situation of oppression. Of course, the other one is the physical defense of the oppressed from the physical oppression of the oppressors. And Imam Ali alayhi salam, of course, this is something he did his whole life, was defending the oppressed masses and the disenfranchised and the downtrodden. And so in this holy month of Ramadan, before it ends, of course, the issue of Palestine is a very serious issue. These are people that are at the ultimate peak of oppression, well over 1 year, where they have been bombed left and right, men, women, children killed mercilessly, hospitals, schools, refugee camps, homes, civilian infrastructure, everything practically destroyed. It'll take decades to rebuild. It'll take tens of billions of dollars to be able to rebuild these broken, and this oppression continues. And so with the values of the holy month of Ramadan and with the values of Imam Ali alayhi salam, it is our duty all across the world to defend these Palestinian people and to defend these oppressed people. The last thing, because I had promised I wanted to speak about too, of course, is that in this holy month of Ramadan, when we were facing and experiencing hunger and thirst, this hunger and thirst, which we voluntarily took upon ourselves, is something that the poor and needy masses of the world don't voluntarily do, but they are forced into poverty poverty, malnutrition, famine. These are things that are very serious and are going and are occurring across the world. And as a Muslim, it is our duty to try to deal with this situation as well, to help the poor, help the needy. This is something that we learn in the holy month of Ramadan. Inshallah, if Allah wills and if all of you pray for all of us, we will be at your service next year in another holy month of Ramadan. A very beautiful lesson indeed, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past, when everything was going so fast, and now I just can't go on. Forgive me for everything I've done in the light, for everything I've done in the night that I thought wasn't wrong. But I know that you are really loving, you are really caring. I can't realize, but you know that I will be better, that I will be stronger if you are by my side.
Now let's listen to Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, who's going to talk about today's topic.
So he's saying, take care of all of these things. Take care of your limbs. Take care of your responsibilities. Why? Because you don't want the end of the month to come, right? And you say, oh, this is another Ramadan I messed up. This is another Ramadan I could have done so much more. And I hope Allah, keeps me again so I could get to another Ramadan, which we might mess up again. You see? So we have to take Ramadan just like Alcoholics Anonymous, one step at a time. Every day, we renew our niyyah. Every day, every second, we remind ourselves that this is the holy month. And definitely, we will be, inshallah, successful. So as guests of Allah, we are honored. And being honored means being recognized in one's being. Being recognized in one's being. In other words, as a guest, being merely present at the banquet gives us an honor, confers upon us some kind of respectability. And the hadith, there are many hadith that talk about us getting benefits over things that we have no control over, and over things that we have control over, but we get more than we should get by those things that we have control over. For example, you have a guest in your house, and you treat that guest with respect. You give that guest honor. Even sometimes that guest might have a tendency or a behavior you might not like. This is as being a guest. Just your presence in the guest room, a presence at the banquet, gives you an honor that is conferred to your very being. And there's a hadith of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi that talks about this, that talks about us getting benefits, getting blessings for those things that we have absolutely no control over. Of course, bearing in mind that you, me, we are the architects of the quality of that banquet that we are attending.
At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد
Oh
Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master, and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, To My Brother. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The Israeli regime has long record of intentionally targeting journalists, a tactic used to silence those exposing its war crimes and human rights violations. In the past 17 months, 208 journalists have been killed by Israeli occupation forces, Assassination of journalist Hossam Shabat is the latest crime.
Hossam was wearing his press hamlet and vest committing to the safety and journalism standards. However, he was hit by an Israeli missile. Hossam was documenting the Israeli bombing and crimes against his people. That's why he got killed. Surely, as journalists, we appeal to the international community to stop the killing of the journalists.
Known for his relentless efforts to expose Israeli war crimes, genocide, and human rights abuses perpetrated against the Palestinian people, Shabbat's killing underscores a disturbing pattern of violence directed towards the press by the Israeli forces to mute any voice calling for justice.
The Israeli occupation deliberately targets the journalists in Gaza since the beginning of the war. Hossam and Mohamed Mansi were killed on the same day, mounting the journalist's death toll to 208. That is an additional proof that the Israeli regime does deliberately and systematically kill the journalists. Prior to his assassination, Hossam was threatened by the Israeli army.
I documented the horrors in northern Gaza minute by minute, determined to show the world the truth they tried to bury. I slept on pavements, in schools, in tents, anywhere I could. Each day was a battle for survival. I endured hunger for months, yet I never left my people's side. That were his last words on X. Shabbat's assassination is a stark reminder that the Israeli regime continues to be engaged in a genocidal campaign against the Palestinians, one that seeks not only to annihilate their bodies, but also to erase their voices. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
The Israeli regime has once again given its green light to a plan that strengthens its grip on the occupied West Bank. The latest move, orchestrated by far-right Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, grants independent status to 13 settler neighborhoods, making them eligible for direct infrastructure and financial support. Analysts warn that this will accelerate land confiscation, allowing the regime to deepen its settlement enterprise at the expense of Palestinian communities.
Annexation is a process, and that's what's happening, like not now. And one of the main junctions for that is in 2020, when that time Trump was in power, and when they announced the annexation plan officially. This is the first time that they announced a map, and they announced about the annexation plan. From there, they started the demolition of the Palestinian communities, taking more and more lands. And also, when this fascist government came to the power, they accelerated this.
For 3 years, the Israeli regime has allocated huge resources to push towards more land grip in Area C. Almost $3 billion were apportioned to make the lives of the settlers easier in the West Bank's stolen lands.
All the settlements had been established in the Area C in the West Bank. Area C, 62% of the West Bank, which all the Palestinian resources there, water resources, agricultural land, everything for the Palestinians. What's been left for the Palestinians out of Area C is Area A and B, which is the built-up area. There's nothing to live on. What they are trying to do is just to make out of the West Bank another 2 or 3 even more Gaza strips in the West Bank, separated cantons that isolated from each other without any resources, depending totally on Israel and under mercy of their military and settlers.
The de facto situation which the regime is imposing every day in the West Bank aims, according to analysts, to expel Palestinians forcibly or willfully.
Israel is expanding settlement outposts, granting them local councils and huge budgets. The upcoming budget includes massive funds for settlement growth, first legalizing outposts, then developing them into full-scale cities. Meanwhile, settler violence targets Palestinian towns, isolating communities and confining them to segregated areas. The goal is clear: make life unbearable for Palestinians, forcing them toward displacement.
Israel has been expanding settlement despite global condemnations. The new separation plan effectively legalizes further land grabs, making it easier to build and connect settlements while cutting off Palestinian areas.
Israel's settlement expansion continues to reshape the West Bank's landscape, making a future Palestine state increasingly unviable. As Palestinian communities face ongoing land seizures, the world remains largely silent. Naqa Ahmed, Ramallah, Occupied West Bank.
March 25th, 2015, the day when the Saudi-led coalition launched a military campaign in Yemen to reinstate former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, an ally of Saudi Arabia. The campaign aimed to push the Ansarullah movement back to Sada in northern Yemen as well. With support from the United States, the coalition also sought to establish a buffer zone between Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
When the Saudi-led aggression against the Yemeni people began in 2015, it had no clear objectives. However, when the aggressors realized they were entangled in this war, they declared an official goal through a meeting at the United Nations Security Council and Resolution 2216, which was to reinstate Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. Yet they failed to achieve this goal, along with all the objectives they had set for their coalition.
The United Nations estimates that the war in Yemen has killed 337,000 people by the end of 2021. The deaths include those caused by both conflict and indirect causes, such as hunger and preventable diseases. According to UN officials, the indirect causes were to blame for the majority of the deaths, as the Saudi-led coalition maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen, a country dependent on international aid to meet its basic needs, even prior to the war.
As the 10th anniversary of the aggression against Yemen arrives, the blockade continues to severely impact the healthcare sector, causing immense suffering due to the ongoing restrictions on medical supplies. During the years of aggression, airstrikes have targeted 55% of the healthcare sector, rendering 98% of medical equipment non-operational, as we have been unable to repair them or secure spare parts.
The years-long war also devastated other key infrastructure, including airports. The airstrikes, coupled with the crippling blockade, created what the United Nations called the world's worst humanitarian crisis, leaving millions struggling for basic necessities.
There have been many tragedies over the past 10 years of the blockade, both in humanitarian terms and in material losses. On the humanitarian side, there have been significant losses of lives, especially among patients with critical illnesses who needed to travel for treatment but were prevented due to the airport closure. In addition, many students were unable to continue their studies, and tourism came to a complete halt, inflicting severe losses on the national economy.
Archaeological sites were not safe from attacks either. According to a 2019 report by the UN's cultural agency UNESCO, Yemeni cultural heritage sites were heavily affected, mostly through collateral damage. Following years of deaths and destruction, a ceasefire was agreed on April 2, 2022, under UN sponsorship. But while the fighting has largely stopped, Yemen's economic crisis continues, and the struggle to rebuild remains an uphill battle.
Even with a ceasefire in place, the scars of war are still visible across Yemen. Families who lost everything now face the challenge of rebuilding their lives amid an economic crisis. For many Yemenis, the road to recovery is far from over. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
The male surgical department inside Nasser Medical Complex in central Khan Yunis, the last haven for those wounded or injured by the Israeli attacks to survive. This place has been turned into blackened ruin as it was targeted last night by the Israeli occupation. At least one airstrike was launched here, destroying this department that was filled with dozens of the patients and the wounded Palestinians who were fighting for their lives. And as the place was set on fire following the attacks, all the patients and the medical crews here were in a state of panic and just rushing to evacuate instantly. But unfortunately, 10 of them, 8 were injured and 2 were killed by this attack, including a 16-year-old child. this place, despite being inside the heart of the Nasser Medical Complex, was deliberately targeted by the Israeli occupation, turning it into ruins.
Hospitals and medical personnel are protected under international and humanitarian law. However, the occupation knows no boundaries or laws. It deliberately targeted this department, rendering it out of service after it had caused the collapse of the medical sector across the Gaza Strip. Two people were killed, and the rooms in this department, including the oxygen station, were destroyed. This is the only male surgical department here, and now we are forced to treat the remaining wounded, who are now injured for the second time, in inadequate and unsuitable conditions. This is a war crime, and we urge the international community to hold the occupation accountable and prevent such atrocities.
Now, this department is officially out of service. All the patients that were here last night and survived the attack were moved by the medical crews here to other facilities and departments here inside the hospital, where they are now uncertain where exactly and how to receive treatment, because they did survive the previous attacks by the occupation, and now they were targeted again, making them sure that no place is safe in Gaza. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
The Israeli bombardment has decimated educational institutions across Gaza and the occupied West Bank, making it nearly impossible for Palestinian students to pursue their studies. Schools and universities have turned to rubble, leaving thousands in despair. But for some, hope still shines. Seven Palestinian students have reached Pakistan to continue their education, with more expected soon. For Palestinian students, education is not just about degrees. It's about survival. Despite losing their homes and universities, they refuse to let the Israeli war define their future. Al-Khidmat Foundation has stepped forward, taking full responsibility for their education and living expenses. These students will enroll in different disciplines in Pakistani universities, ensuring that war does not rob them of their dreams.
We are from Gaza. And since the war, Israeli war in Gaza, all the universities are distracted and stop studying, and this will stop the educational process in Gaza. So we are taking this choice to go to Pakistan to continue our studies there.
I'm a teacher assistant at the university. I have studied 5 years of computer engineering at the university, and I came here to continue my studying master degree at data science at university for data science.
This isn't the first time Pakistan has opened its door to Palestinian students. Last year, Palestinian medical students arrived in Lahore, reflecting the resilience of a generation fighting for its future.
We believe education is the strongest form of resistance. We stand with our Palestinian brothers and will ensure they get the education they deserve.
As Israeli aggression continues, their right to education remains under attack in Palestine. But these students prove that no amount of destruction can erase their will to learn. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Students at prestigious Georgetown University protested in defense of the latest academic detained and scheduled for deportation by the administration of Donald Trump, Badr Khan Suri, their professor at the school's Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding.
One, we are demanding the release of Dr. Suri. Two, we are demanding that this university become a sanctuary campus, which means the university must not allow ICE, DHS, and MPD onto campus, and the university must not aid in the arrest and deportation of students. And three, we are demanding complete divestment from entities complicit in the ongoing genocide in Palestine.
Hundreds of protesters have been arrested recently across the United States at rallies for deported scholars. Many for the most notorious deportation case, that of Mahmoud Khalil at Columbia University in New York City. Both Suri and Khalil were legal U.S. residents, married to American citizens, and never charged with breaking any laws. Unlike Khalil, Suri was not involved in political activism, but was still charged with allegedly spreading pro-Hamas propaganda.
One academic's deportation read, quote, "Your presence or activities in the United States would have adverse consequences for the foreign policy of the United States." The question is, adverse for whom?
We can see through the military-industrial complex, the one that is making the ruling class in this country millions, billions of dollars, that if that was to be threatened, if Palestine was to be liberated, if the masses of this country actually are educated on what's happening and not being fed the U.S. propaganda around what we're seeing in the Middle East, it would be not detrimental to the U.S. foreign policy and the U.S. Domestic policy as well, but just more so detrimental to these people's pockets.
The United States is currently undergoing a lengthy anti-Palestinian witch hunt, which can only be compared to the anti-socialist Red Scares from 1917 to 1920, and then again from 1947 to 1957.
It hasn't just started with Donald Trump. You know, it's gotten much worse, but there was already, you know, efforts here on campus to repress pro-Palestinian speech. It's never been truly welcomed as free speech, even before Donald Trump.
A federal judge just blocked the deportation of Suri, but refused to release him back to his wife and three young children, and Suri remains in jail. Ramin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Allah's forgiveness in Ramadan. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, here on IB English Radio. And obviously the title tells us it's, yeah. So this is about Allah's forgiveness. And obviously Allah is the most forgiving. And during the month of Ramadan, very special things happen. And so I'm just going to go through some of these very special things, because I think being aware of the extra forgiveness that Allah sort of gives to people during the month of Ramadan might then also make us even more inclined to be doing the good things and to be avoiding anything that's bad in any way. So obviously there is this special promise of Allah's pardon during this holy month of Ramadan, according to traditions. So, for example, and I'm just going to list some of these traditions, and I don't know if everyone's aware of these. They're very beautiful. So, for example, it said that Allah pardons 70 million people who would otherwise be punished in hell at the time of iftar each night during Ramadan. So just think to yourself, so every night, every single night of those 30 nights of Ramadan, each time there's iftar, that evening, 70 million people, so 70 million of us Muslims, are being pardoned. So that's every night. So just do the maths yourself. Then it said that at the end of Ramadan, Allah also forgives an additional number of sinners, equivalent to that total sum of those that he'd already pardoned during the month. So obviously you've got on 30 nights, each of those 30 nights, 70 million people are being pardoned. And then Allah at the end of the month will be pardoning that same amount again. So this is huge. Welcome back. This is A to Z and IB English Radio, me, Sister Zainab, and I'm talking particularly about Allah's huge, massive forgiveness during the holy month of Ramadan. And so obviously I've just quoted the one tradition where every night 70 million people are pardoned from being punished in hell, and then the equivalent amount to the